Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Wild plants and animals have been with us humans since the dawn of our species. Depending on who you talk to, that's between 100 and 200,000 years. But it's only in the last 125 years or so that we as a community began taking action to see that those living things remain part of our world. That's called conservation. Kurt Ault has had experience on five continents with how people try to do it. Kurt, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for being here, Brian.
Where'd you grow up? What did your folks do?
I grew up in Butte, but I was born in Glasgow. Learned how to swim on the Little Missouri in southeastern Montana. Grew up in Butte, but I do have a North Dakota Social Security number.
What did you learn growing up that still sticks with you?
When you speak, you better be telling the truth. You better be honest and frank. And if you aren't, you're liable to be held accountable for it at some point in time in your life.
And did that come from your folks or something else?
That came from growing up in Butte.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
All right. Where'd you go to school?
Montana State University. Earned 2 degrees, a bachelor's and a master's.
In?
Fish and wildlife management.
And what led you to that interest?
Lifelong interest in wild things, in nature. I loved plants. I loved animals. I always had questions. I think one of my first pets was a pet grasshopper.
Really? Now, that's a first in this show in almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
I put him in a jar, and I wanted to see what he ate. So I put different grasses and different forbs in the jar, and I realized the grasshopper liked a lot of grass and would eat just about any plant material I put in there.
I won't ask you if you ever housebroke them.
No.
All right, so you go to college, you get a master's. What did you learn from that experience in terms of the academic side? What did you learn about wildlife and biology that you didn't know?
I learned that there's a lot of history that has gone into where we are today in terms of management, in terms of science, in terms of the social and the political aspects of wildlife management. I pretty much was taught to think of my profession as applying the art of wildlife management, because it wasn't just science. It was, if you couldn't take the science and convert it into understandable information for the general public, that certainly wouldn't translate into good programs on the ground that conserved populations or habitat.
Now, you then worked as a wildlife biologist for how long?
I worked for the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks for 35 years. The first few years were getting my feet wet, but I spent the first 25 years of my career as a field-level biologist. I always kind of talk about it as being entry-level. And then the last 7 years, I was the wildlife manager for southwestern Montana, so I moved up one level.
And what's the difference in the jobs?
The different biologist positions that I held east and west of the divide had a real geographic difference, a habitat difference, species difference. The difference in the wildlife manager position, I became the chief wildlife biologist for southwestern Montana. So I had 8 wildlife biologists and access and habitat guys.
So what do they do? In nuts and bolts, okay. What does a wildlife biologist do? Not the manager. We know he sits around and smokes cigars, but... What's the job, nuts and bolts?
Nuts and bolts is to gather information on both habitat and populations to be able to, for those animals that we hunt or trap, to be able to provide annual recommendations for quotas and develop season types. As importantly is, because our biologists we're situated in different communities, become an important person in that community where they're sharing that information with the public, landowners, people that live in town, people that live out of town, any of the community interests, to really help them understand what you're seeing, what they're seeing, and then help develop regulation recommendations, quota recommendations, to be delivered to those people, the commissioners, that will make a decision whether they're going to implement a certain type on those species that we hunt, on trap. They're also, as a field biologist, you're a habitat specialist, not only just a wildlife specialist. So you're looking at plants and vegetation, soil, looking at grazing systems, how they apply on the landscape, how they can be modified to be accommodating for a wide variety of wildlife species, timber harvest, oil and gas leases. And then there's a certain element where you're also looking at holistically the ground. You know, what species are there? What are we missing? What are we doing? What could we be doing better as habitat and population biologists, knowing that you don't do it by yourself? You're doing it with private landowners, federal and state and federal land management agencies.
That covers a lot of ground, literally and figuratively. To develop sound recommendations based on utilizing your analytical and scientific skills, it implies that there are enough of you out there to collect the data that's necessary. For example, we have a regional or a zone system for hunting elk and mule deer and whitetails. Geographical boundaries. The implication of the system is you have enough biologists to get good enough information to make sound recommendations. Is that your experience? Because often government agencies are underfunded, in my experience.
That is my experience in Montana. I think the other element to that is because it's the biologists work with each other and they work across the landscape on private, federal, or state land, there's an ability to look beyond a fence boundary as to what is happening in this region of the state versus that region of the state. And often those what are implemented in one area does have an impact on others. So there's a collaboration across, so to speak, fence boundaries to make sure that our recommendations are appropriate to a landscape level.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with former wildlife biologist Kurt Ault. I say former because you are retired, is that correct?
That's correct.
There's a second implication, I think, to what you've just said. When you commented on communicating with landowners and other interested parties and, parenthesis, the commission, very few of whom, if any, are wildlife biologists. So there's an implication there that you believe that the people in your profession have the ability to communicate what seems to me to be pretty complicated information to lay people, and they can absorb it, and in the case of the commission, use it rationally to make decisions. On a scale of 1 to 10, I want you to rate two things. First, in your career and over your into a long period of time, how do you rate the ability of wildlife biologists to communicate scientific information to the lay public? Scale of 1 to 10.
9.
And the ability of the public, whether it's the commission or hunters or landowners, to absorb it?
9.9.
And then I'll draw one further implication, since we have, that's the way we make decisions in our system of wildlife management / conservation. To the extent that the data is good and the communication and ability to absorb it is good, that suggests, in your opinion, the system works pretty well. Am I wrong or right?
I think you're right. In Montana, when people are given good information, usually good decisions result.
Now, I said at the top of the program you have had experience with wildlife conservation on 5 continents. We've got one. That's where we're sitting now. Tell us about the others. Where and what?
My first international experience was with Argentina in what we call the Partners for Americas program. And when I went there, I went there specifically to try to understand how their system of conservation works, to share our experiences and how we do things in Montana and to learn from them. One of the things that hit me right off the bat is the aristocracy in terms of hunting is still alive and well in Argentina. Basically, the people that hunt there are the wealthy North Americans and wealthy Europeans. And although wildlife belonged to all the people in the states or are held in trust by all the people in the states under their constitution, the people really don't have access. And one particular conversation I had with an estancia owner.
Estancia is a piece of land.
Ranch owner. They call them estancias, was a former Spanish aristocratic family. And I asked, how did he manage red deer populations? Because they're introduced and they were explosive when they were introduced. They grew to high numbers.
Okay.
And I said, so do you use the public and the communities around your ranch?
Help make the decision or to manage?
To manage, to actually remove animals, reduce populations. Mm-hmm. And he said, I would rather kill the animals and leave them rot on the ground than allow peasants on my land to hunt red deer, even if it's just for meat. So there was a real strong separation. There's not a hunting culture that ever really developed in the people of Argentina that live
and work. The common people.
Mm-hmm. And so I would describe that system as somewhat aristocratic in nature and really fueled by primarily out-of-country hunters.
So then in Argentina, who made the decisions about length of seasons, et cetera?
In a broad brush way, the government made decisions on season lengths, but oftentimes the number of animals are going to be determined by the landowner or the government on government lands without a public process.
What about the level of wildlife biologists? Would you get enough experience to compare those in those two situations?
They have some outstanding wildlife biologists in Argentina. They have no money to do their work. They have no funding base to support field work. Three or four biologists may share one vehicle on a daily basis.
Okay, so the implication of that then is less science applied to the decision, more private landowner control.
Correct.
Fair?
Correct.
Okay, the third continent.
I would go to East Africa, and that was a collaboration between MSU, UC Davis, and Yellowstone Park and the Serengeti Masamara region of East Africa, Kenya and Tanzania, and then their biologists outside the protected areas in Kenya and Tanzania and me outside of Yellowstone in Montana to represent how things are managed on landscapes where people live and work. And in that example, I can talk to two stories real briefly. One was Dr. Emmanuel Greta from Tanzania looked at me after about 5 years of collaboration and said, I finally get in Montana what you do. You sell an opportunity. In Tanzania, we sell a quota. And what he meant is, I understand how you can continue to sell licenses with really poor success, say on elk hunting, maybe 15% of the people are successful in a given year on bull hunting. And there, if you sell an opportunity to go hunting, that person is expected to kill, to have an automatic harvest. And he said, now I finally understand. You maximize opportunity, you maximize resident participation over harvest. And then the other example was from Kenya, and it was a fellow by the name of Oli Kamaro. He was a Maasai from Kenya, and he told me a story that when Lake Leakey ran the wildlife part of Kenya, a white man, the people, the different tribes, including Maasai, had no access to their wildlife in Kenya. It was, again, reserved for wealthy North Americans and Europeans. Then the government changed hands, and he was bemoaning the fact that the tribes and local people, including the Maasai, still don't have access to their wildlife because wealthy North Americans and Europeans came in and bought the government to basically demonstrate you don't need to have hunting to have conservation. And he was...
How do you mean, bought the government?
Well, influenced the government. How he said bought, but influenced the government to not have any hunting, to allow no hunting in Kenya. And that meant residents as well, the people that live and work with hyenas and lions and elephants and zebras and on the landscape outside of protected areas, they still had no access to those wildlife in a utilitarian sense.
Okay, so let me just ask you this then. In the second example, the animals' populations fluctuated through phenomena absent of hunting. Do I understand correctly? If they outlawed hunting.
If they outlawed hunting, correct. But they still killed animals that were problem animals, but it wasn't done by the people, it was done by the government. So the common person in Kenya had no access to those resources.
And no say in the decision.
Correct.
The fourth continent.
The Russian Far East, and so it's way on the other side of the country from Moscow. And there they were struggling after Perestroika how they were going to manage hunting in a place where they have Amur tigers, we more commonly called Siberian tigers. We would know them as Siberian tigers. But they called them Amur tigers. And they were struggling with how did they raise more red deer, which are native in Russia, our equivalent to European elk.
Okay.
How to raise more red deer, because it was important both from a hunting standpoint and from a tiger conservation standpoint.
Because they're a prey species.
For both people and tigers.
Okay.
And so part of that was an exploration on how to do that and what kind of hunting systems could you use to fuel conservation for tigers. And
what did you learn there? Now, you worked with Dale Markell, is it?
Yeah, Dale Markell with the Wildlife Conservation Society. And we went and actually viewed, our last year, viewed some hunting leases. They call them hunting leases in the Russian Far East. They're like a large, complex group of hunting districts in Montana. But it's a large geographic area, each hunting lease, and it has a manager. And some of the hunting leases were providing a certain percentage, about 95% of their allocation to shoot red deer, were provided to non-residents.
Presumably because they can pay more.
And they call them wealthy North Americans, wealthy Europeans, and the new Muscovites, the new wealth in Moscow.
Okay.
They called them non-residents as well. And other hunting leases were doing just almost the opposite. They were providing about 85% of the hunting opportunities to the people that lived in that geographic area.
Who made the decision one way or the other? The manager had the authority to make the decision?
The manager of the hunting lease had that authority.
And is that a government position?
Yes. And so the bottom line is the person that was maximizing the opportunity for the people that lived and worked in that area, mm-hmm. they didn't have wardens to guard against poaching. They were building tolerance for tigers by having access to a resource that in a neighboring hunting lease they never had access to. And so those places that had the highest percentage of hunters being non-resident hunters, so to speak.
The wealthy.
They had game wardens. They had constant patrolling of the property, trying to keep the peasants, so to speak, away
right.
from their elk. And so there were more poaching issues in terms of fueling tiger conservation.
Yeah, who was more successful in getting more tigers?
My impression is that those places where people that lived and worked there had access to their resources required less patrolling. There was a more of an ownership of, okay, we can share this resource with tigers. And their bottom line is they wanted to grow more red deer, and they were asking us how they might do that. And so to have a higher number of red deer producing babies, so there's more deer for both hunters and tigers.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with longtime wildlife biologist Kurt Ault. And in the Far Eastern Russia example, how would you compare the number of biologists on the ground with Montana?
Almost non-existent. If there are 45 wildlife biologists in the state of Montana, they maybe had one.
So then just the implication of that is decisions about habitat, strategies to increase red deer is left to whom?
Well, it's left to those hunt lease, the hunt managers, but ultimately the scientists in Moscow, it'd be like people in Washington, D.C. deciding how many elk people in Montana could harvest, or what would be the harvest in Montana.
Without any data, that's the implication.
They get data, they get harvest information, they do get some survey data, but very small amount. On minimal data, people in Moscow are deciding how many red deer people in Primorsky Krai are going to shoot.
Yeah, one difference, it's not three time zones, it's probably eight or nine from
exactly.
Moscow to Siberia.
Yeah.
So that qualifies as Asia. What's the fifth continent?
Europe. During the last 4 years, I've spent considerable time on the other side of the ocean trying to understand how conservation works there and really what role hunting does still play in conservation there. And
there being where in Europe?
I've looked at a number of countries, but I'm most familiar with Germany.
All right.
And Germany is about the size of Montana, a little smaller. It has about 82 to 85 million people.
And only, 82 to 85 million, we have one.
We have one.
Okay.
It's actually the most densely populated country in all of Europe. And yet hunting still pays for a lot of the conservation that takes place on the ground. The difference in that system, but only 0.3% of Germans hunt.
0.3%. And in Montana, it must be 35, 40%?
Between hunting and fishing, probably close to that. You know, I think probably 17 to 19% hunt and the others fish.
So tell us more about that.
Well, there it's interesting because the landowner owns the hunting right in Germany. And it's not just the private landowner, but like Montana, about 30% of Germany is either state or federal ownership as well.
Well, how is that different? Because functionally speaking here, on private ground, the landowner owns the trespass right. So what's the difference?
The difference is the landowner there will decide, not necessarily unilaterally, but nearly unilaterally, how many animals need to be killed in a given year with the hunters. But the other element that's really different is game meat is the market in Europe and in Germany. Game meat, you can sell game meat in Europe.
So let me just get this straight. If I'm hunting on your place, I assume I pay you in Germany for the right to hunt probably, or most of the time?
Most of the time.
And you own the meat and sell it, or I own the meat and sell it?
It depends on the arrangement.
Okay, but the meat is sold in the market.
Correct.
Okay, now let's just stop and take a look at that. I think the principal historical source of the near eradication of game species in the United States was market hunting, and it was banned more than 100 years ago.
Correct.
How are they doing?
Well, they're doing pretty good. I have to say a little bit more context to that story. Prior to the French Revolution and the revolutions in the mid-1800s, the wealthy owned the wildlife, pretty much had access to the high game. And that means the peasant, the commoner could not hunt. After the revolutions, people owned property, they owned property, and at that point in time, they gave the right to hunt to the private landowner. By the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, Europe was almost like North America in terms of over-exploitation of populations.
Okay.
Because the farmers saw nothing but a problem in red deer or roe deer or wild boar, and they finally had the opportunity to get rid of them, and so they hunted them to very small levels. So the restoration period in Europe started in early 1900s, certainly is focused in Germany. And so what came of that is that the private owner owns the right to hunt. But what will help people understand is, so does the government. So if you hunt on a state property, you have to pay the government to hunt there. And if you shoot something, like private land, you get the head, the hide, and the guts. If you want the meat, you're going to pay a per kilo price, a euro per kilo. For a wild boar, it would be 4 euro a kilo, roughly. For red deer and roe deer, it would be 6 euro a kilo. So it's really expensive.
So under that structure, who sets seasons and bag limits?
Essentially, the federal government will set a countrywide season framework, and within that framework, the states in Germany and the landowners will set their own bag limits and can become more restrictive or more liberal with bag limits.
Let's talk comparisons. It sounds like in each of the continents, your experience is hunting is a key part of the equation. Fair enough?
Yep.
What purpose does it serve?
It will engage the public in some way, in different ways, in different governance. In as being a participant in wildlife management and conservation.
Okay, but in some of the cultures, there are very limited hunting opportunities.
Where hunting is applied, it generates funding, a funding source that can be applied to conservation of some sort. But it's applied differently. In Africa, a lot of the money from hunting goes to anti-poaching. Very little of the money from hunting revenue goes to actual science-based management. And I think you can look to that other places I've been, including Europe, most of the revenue generated from hunting in other parts of the world go to either directly to a landowner or to anti-poaching activities. Very little of it goes to science-based management.
Something that jumped out at me was the dramatic difference in the level of public involvement, both in terms of hunting, the average person, and in terms of participation in the decision-making process. Fair?
Fair. Right on.
Any implications for conservation from that in your experience or opinion?
Yeah, I think in terms of really establishing something that can survive politics, that can survive changing governance, political elections, having that that public involvement, that engaged public, that almost it creates a sense of ownership in Montana in their wildlife resource, leads to decisions made in the legislature. It leads to the kinds of people get elected to the state of Montana legislature that makes the laws that govern wildlife policy in Montana. You don't see that in other parts of the world. You don't see that public engagement.
Now, let me just get this straight. The public engagement sounds like it takes two things. One, legal structure enabling public participation, and two, the common person hunting and feeling a sense of ownership. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Then another difference that I heard you discuss was in some cases, some of the Russian hunting preserves, Africa, you had wealthy people coming often from out of the area to hunt, would be the source of revenue, local people not being able to hunt. Any other implications of that difference?
Yeah, I think what you see is a lack of engagement by people that live and work on those landscapes. In the same sense that you might see in Montana, real political, they exert a political will in Montana. They elect people. They are very voiceful in their governance. And yet in these other countries, maybe their governance isn't as open as ours. But even with that, they still aren't as engaged. They don't have opportunities to influence the political process.
And like they don't care as much if they don't have access to the resource.
That's correct. That's correct.
Someone might make the argument that by privileging non-residents who pay much more to hunt than Montanans, you'd raise more money for better science. What's your response?
My response is by doing that, if the pendulum goes too far and the common person from Montana, it becomes so restrictive for him or her to have access to the resource, you lose the political, that sense of ownership in the residents. You lose that political will. The residents are the ones that elect our public officials in the legislature. And you eventually lose the opportunity for Montana to carry forth in the policies and the laws that are enacted because of that resident engagement.
You're basically saying, it seems to me, that the democratic engagement of the hunting public matters and has a constructive effect on conservation over the long term. Someone might say the average person does not know enough to have an informed opinion, and therefore their interest might be counterproductive to scientific management. What would you say to that argument?
I don't believe that to be true. I think when people are given good information, I don't care if they're lawyers or ditch diggers or anybody else in between, good decisions usually come from that information.
Kurt Ault, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.